changes. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 553 of Unwelcome Guests, US Interventionism, Then and Now. I'm Robin Upton. We've got two speakers for you on the show. In our second hour, the Venerable Noam Chomsky. In our first, Tariq Ali. Both of them from earlier this month, that's May 2011. Certainly not the kind of thing that commercially motivated media would serve up to a US public. It comes from Radio New Zealand. This is the second of a series of three lectures by Tariq Ali. The first two are available for download from radioforall.net, and by the time you hear this, the third one will probably have been posted. This is from the 8th of May 2011.
When I gave the first lecture in this series, we talked about the likely impacts of the military assault from above on Libya, which is now in full flow. Situation is still confused, and I will return to that subject later at the conclusion of my talk. But essentially, I want to start with an account of the American Empire and challenge the view, together with many other historians, who essentially present a picture of early United States, even pre-independence, as essentially the city on a hill, a Protestant utopia, where they intended to do only good, and that what happened later somehow happened by accident. I don't think this is accurate. And even the first settlers in Massachusetts were very keen to establish control of the land on which they, at which they arrived and where they settled. And they used the divine law in order to justify this, because this was the law commonly under use, both by the divine right to rule by kings and the divine right to occupy and take over land by settlers. They went together. And there is an apocryphal story of how worried at one point whether or not they were doing the right thing, they organized a meeting of the community and then decided, after a long discussion, who does the land belong to? The land belongs to God. Who are the followers of God? We are the only followers of God in this land. Ergo, the land belongs to us. And John Quincy Adams, one of the founding fathers of the United States, spelt this out very clearly and very bluntly. Shall the Indian doom an immense region of the globe to perpetual desolation and to hear the howlings of the tiger and the wolf silence forever the voice of human gladness? Shall the fields and the valleys, which a beneficent God has framed to teem with the life of innumerable multitudes, be condemned to everlasting barrenness? Shall the mighty rivers poured out by the hands of nature as channels of communication between numerous nations roll their waters in sullen silence and eternal solitude to the deep? Have hundreds of commodious harbors, 1,000 leagues of coast, and a boundless ocean been spread in front of this land, and shall every purpose of utility to which they could apply be prohibited by the tenant of the woods? No, generous philanthropists, Heaven has not been thus inconsistent in the work of its hands. And stretching this particular argument further, that particular view, once the United States had become independent, was utilized first for expansionism within, the large-scale wiping out of the native citizens, systematically and brutally in most cases, and subsequently expanding to take over large tracts of Mexican territory, which gave them California, which provided Texas, taking Oregon from the Brits, and later New Orleans from the French. Now, this may well have been part of divine providence, but manifest destiny. But someone was there on earth, in the new heaven, organizing and carrying out these measures. So the notion that it was accidental, doesn't match with the evidence that is available. Of course, there were debates and arguments that took place, and there were a few brave souls who argued against some of this. But by and large, the decision was taken. The second thing, which it's important to understand, because its consequences haven't totally disappeared, is that right from the beginning, pre-independence and post-independence, there were two or three Americas. One was, of course, the America of the settlers and the British Army sent there, English people largely. Then there was the America of the Native Americans, who were thinly populating. And thirdly, some decades later, there were people who didn't want to go there at all, but were physically taken there by force, and these were the slaves. And of these Americas, the natives did not have much of a say, because a lot of them were wiped out. But the slave population of the United States was a constant worry and a threat, a permanent threat, which determined U.S. policies, if we want to call it that, foreign policy, external policies, right from the word go. The first slave uprising that took place, successful slave uprising, created its own state, was in Haiti after the success of the French Revolution, and Toussaint Louverture, the first leader of the Haitian Republic, no longer a slave republic, referred to himself as a black Jacobin and was in fact greatly inspired by the French Revolution, who he thought would automatically extend the rights they were promising their own people to the colonies. The Jacobins did, and finally, it was during the Jacobin period of the French Revolution that a Jacobin envoy was sent to Haiti. Sontenax was his name, if I remember correct. And they did a deal that the Jacobins would recognize Haiti. They were then toppled, there were clashes, fierce battles, and Haiti became independent. Now, we're talking about the late 18th century. You can imagine, and the Haitian victors, Haitian blacks, who won their independence and freedom in that century, made no secret of the fact that they wanted their revolution to be a beacon to slave populations everywhere. One of Toussaint's generals said, and if we can build up Haiti to be a strong power, we will send our ships and our men and our weapons to go and liberate the slaves in North America and elsewhere in this continent where slavery is tolerated. Now, this was not an empty threat, but more important than this threat was the example of Haiti. And news, of course, spread like wildfire to slave plantations all over the United States, in the southern parts of the United States. And they did trigger off rebellions. So the American establishment was not completely wrong when they saw this as a very important event. And it's very interesting that whereas Quincy Adams, who was hostile to slavery, said there was a discussion, should we recognize the Haitian Republic? After all, we are a republic and the Haitians are a republic, or should we not? And the arguments used against him were, if you recognize the Haitian Republic, essentially you will be giving a green light to the slaves in our country to rise and emulate what their Haitian brothers have done. And when he was succeeded by Jefferson, Jefferson himself, a slaveholder and a defender, albeit a more liberal defender, but a defender of slavery, said that not only do we not recognize the Haitian Republic, but if Napoleon is sending troops to go and destroy the Republic, we should give him backing. And even if he uses Haiti, as they were doing, as a stepping stone for their New Orleans sort of protectorate, so be it. This was far more important. And this attitude of the white elite in that country went very deep. During the War for Independence, for instance, when the British approached Charleston, the local patriots, as they described themselves, fighting against the British, were faced with a choice. What if they mobilized all their support, all the men in the area, which they had already done, and some had already fought the British, to go and fight the British? What of the thousands of slaves left alone on the plantations? Because a bulk of their people were always left behind to guard the slaves. And the British said very clearly, we're going to attack you, and we're going to take your slaves away. They didn't say free them, they said we will expropriate your slaves. And the choice is yours. You fight us, we'll defeat you and take your slaves away. They didn't fight. And in a number of other areas, this argument was used, sometimes in a more liberal fashion, that we will free your slaves if you fight us, and they didn't. They didn't fight. It was the bulk of the fighting ultimately was accomplished in other parts of the country. The big slaveholders, given a choice between being ruled by Britain or freeing their slaves, chose the former. That is what they preferred. And so the question of slavery is usually remembered simply as the outcome now of the famous Civil War, but it went much, much deeper than that. And it determined U.S. policy in the region for many years to come, and it's something that shouldn't be totally forgotten. And this was also a time, a period, in which the word humanitarian was often used by those battling the United States, the British Empire principally, but not just them, the Spanish and the French. And the slaves were always brought in, implying that the other big powers were somehow hostile to slavery, which they weren't, since they traded in them themselves, though it was abolished in Britain in the early 19th century, after which Britain made great use of the fact that it had abolished slavery and were carrying out police operations against ships usually belonging to rival powers. And most of Africa was taken over, conquered, on the humanitarian argument we've come to wipe out slavery, though slavery itself was not ended for many, many decades later, both in North America and in South America, where Brazil was the largest slave country and was the last country to finally abolish slavery with extremely grim consequences for its own future. And as you know, in the United States, though slavery was abolished, a deal was done with the planters, and the Reconstruction period came to an end very quickly. And those who argued that the victory in the Civil War was a very noble victory and should now be used to give the former slaves 4 acres and a mule, which had been the promise, and other lands, and enfranchised them so they could vote. That never happened, because for some, the fight against the South had essentially been a struggle, not so much against slavery, but to create one strong centralized state. And many of the Northerners who fought in that war were not that opposed to slavery, if one's being totally honest. I mean, it was a convenient thing to use, and some genuinely believed in it, especially Sumner and to a large extent Lincoln, but many other politicians used it to take back the South, to punish them for what they had done in rebelling against the North and in creating a strong, powerful, centralized state, which they established. 50 years later, the United States had decided that its main area of intervention would be the Southern Hemisphere, would be South America, their backyard, as they called it, and the Monroe Doctrine was put into action to stop rival powers like Britain, France, Spain from interfering too much with American aims in that region. And similar agreements were worked out in the Pacific region, where, I mean, this is now not the case, but for a long time in those centuries, you never had one large imperial power, overpowerful, etc. You had a number of empires, of which the British was the most economically significant and hence militarily powerful, which built the largest empire, but the French had an empire, the Spanish Empire had been wrested away from them by Simon Bolivar and the movements for national liberation that spread all over South America. And the Germans were beginning to, wanting to create an empire. Bismarck, the German Chancellor, said very clearly, if the Americans can have their part of the world, and the Brits can have, British and French can have their colonies, why not us? And he went about to get the colonies in Africa and in the Pacific. I don't know, I mean, there was the argument used by the Germans was that the Americans have taken Hawaii, the British have taken Fiji, and got Australia and New Zealand, and the Germans have nothing. So he said, can I have Samoa, please? And the Americans and the British said, no, well, you can share that with us, but you can't have it all on your own. And he said, why not? You know, you've got Fiji, you've got Hawaii, I just want these islands. And they said, no, you can't. And they almost came to war over Samoa. But if you look back and read the descriptions of the native peoples, Pacific peoples of those islands, just quite shocking, actually. I deliberately didn't read them out because then it becomes a horror story. But, I mean, the way they regarded the people, they were essentially seen as completely uncouth, primitive subhumans who had to be civilized, which in many cases meant Christianized and converted voluntarily, if possible, and by force, if necessary, which usually accompanied conquests of smaller places or places with fewer populations. The Spanish did it in the most systematic way, which is why there were less natives killed in South America, precisely because once they were converted, the Spanish were quite happy to live with them and even intermarry. So you had a whole structure. The Protestants were far more hardline, as you know, you can see from what happened in North America. And large numbers of natives survived in Mexico, in the Andean regions. The only country where they were virtually completely wiped out was Argentina. But with that exception, they did survive in rather well in many, many parts of that of South America. These inter-imperial conflicts were what ultimately led to the First World War and to a certain extent to the Second World War. And it was the Germans feeling betrayed that they had not been allowed to build an empire that their size and strength in Europe permitted. That was the way leading politicians thought at the time, Bismarck first and then Hitler after him. The question of the empire, Germany not being able to have its own empire, was crucial to both men. Bismarck, as I've just described, finally did get Namibia and a few other territories in Southwest Africa, but nothing to compare with his fellow leaders and countries in Europe. And if you read some of Hitler's speeches, I mean, they are, you know, he doesn't always rant and attack the Jews. There is a line of argument there. And that line of argument, once, you know, he returns to time and again because he knows this is an old German ruling class obsession. Space. Constantly. People say we shouldn't have space. Why? And he talked about the Monroe Doctrine. The Americans have got two virtual continents. The British have got India. What have we Germans got? So we need our own Lebensraum, our own space, and it's best if this is Europe. Since these are the people who've stopped us from getting our own empire, we'll take them. That was the argument which he used and which was not unpopular in Germany amongst non-fascist members of the German elite. One reason they supported him is not because of his anti-Jewish rants. Two reasons they supported him. One, that he promised to make Germany great after the humiliation of the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles and all the humiliations and privations that imposed on them, which they hadn't forgotten. And secondly, they felt he was the only person and the only party leader in the country who could defeat the rising threat from socialist and communist parties, which was very strong. Because together, the German socialists and the German communists used to get about 60% of the vote. Had they united to form a united front government, it's a moot point whether Hitler would have come to power. Maybe he still would have by using force. But in any case, these were the arguments, and empire figured a great deal in it. So the American entry on the world stage came during the First World War when two things were happening. One, the Germans, after being stymied, had begun to advance again, and it was made clear to the United States, which at that time was not that committed to defending the British and the French, that if the Germans defeated Britain and France and seized their empires, they would become a real threat globally. And secondly, that the World War was destabilizing countries all over Europe, and empires were being threatened and destroyed. And it's very interesting that the decision essentially taken by the United States was to enter the First World War was virtually coincidental with the February 1917 revolution in Russia and the fall of the Tsar. Because the First World War broke up three huge empires, the Tsarist, the Austro-Hungarian, and the Ottoman Empire, which had a lasting impact on world history and determined the politics of the 20th century. Once they realized the seriousness of the situation, Woodrow Wilson said, we will now go and make war in order to preserve peace. And they came in. By that time, Russia was out of the war because the victorious revolutions, first in February, then in October, said we're not fighting anymore. Troops began to desert, and that was that. And the defeat of the Austro-Hungarians opened up new possibilities, and the Germans said they would fight for the debt to that, but they couldn't. It was American, the American entry of the American army, which was decisive, and the Germans were defeated and then punished, which didn't stop them from making war again because of the way in which their defeat was handled. So after the Second World War, you saw two developments. Let me say this, that between the First and Second World Wars, it was still not the case that the United States was a dominant power. The British were still strong. The French had their colonies. So it can be argued that the European imperial powers did not emerge completely weakened after the First World War. And the United States actually was strengthened after that war and seen for the first time as a player on the world stage. At the same time, you had waves now of revolutionary upheavals in Europe, as happens after every revolution, as happened after the French Revolution and even after the English Revolution of the 17th century. There are people, other parts of the world, who want to mimic that success. And they either succeed or fail, but to different degrees they attempt to carry those things out. And the Russian Revolution unleashed a wave of uprisings in Hungary, in Germany, and by and large, the owners of property, capital and land, decided that the best way to save their property was to back those parties which were holding the Bolsheviks at bay. The victory of Mussolini in Italy was greeted by the United States and Britain as a tremendous step forward for humanity. And Mussolini's memoirs, published in several editions by an English publishing house, was introduced by the U.S. ambassador, who said that Mussolini is one of the greatest statesmen the world has ever seen. Which was normal, because they saw it, you know, ideologically and from their point of view and from their interest. So it's not totally surprising. Churchill himself paid enormous tributes to Mussolini, which Mussolini used for the rest of his life, saying, look, I'm not as bad as Hitler, even Churchill liked me. But the rise of German nationalism, and a particularly virulent form of German nationalism, meant that they could no longer depend on these countries. I mean, if it's one thing if they just attacked, destroyed the local socialists and communists, but it was another thing if they were going to take on these other European powers, which is why for a whole period the French and the British, people who were later called the appeasers, attempted to divert Hitler to attack the Russians, because that would have been helpful from their point of view, since both of these giant armies and powers could have bled each other to death. But neither country did it, and the Russians then negotiated their own deal with Hitler after the Brits and the French had refused to get him on side. And the people who tried to do it, again, did it, you know, from imperial motive, self-interest. They were not interested in the ideology of Hitler. No one even spoke much about the Jews, because anti-Semitism was not simply confined to Germany. It existed. There were huge anti-Semitic currents in France, for instance. Not that huge in Britain, it has to be said, but in France, anti-Semitism went very deep indeed, as people found out when that country was occupied and the huge number of people who collaborated. And in many cases, seeing those documentaries now is shocking. Welcomed Hitler. He was greeted by large crowds when he visited France. They're not shown that often, but some French filmmakers have revived them just to show people of what it was like. So Europe between the wars was in a very dangerous situation. And when Hitler didn't attack Russia initially, but decided to take Belgium, France, and possibly Britain, that transformed politics again, because now everyone felt that this was an important war. The United States kept out of it for a long time. And it's an interesting counterfactual, what might or might not have happened had the Japanese not stupidly attacked Pearl Harbor, but instead attacked Siberia, which the Japanese high command was discussing, because there were not all that many Russian divisions on their Siberian front. They had diverted all of them to fight Hitler and his armies at invading the Soviet Union. And as you know, it was a bloody war, finally settled by two huge victories, the Battle of Kursk, which was the largest tank battle of the Second World War, and the defeat at German Stafford at Stalingrad, where for the first time in German history a field marshal surrendered instead of committing suicide, which sent shockwaves through the Prussian high command. But in terms of the Japanese, it's a mystery. Actually, very few people have managed to explain it, why they'd took that particular decision, but they did. And that decision then made American entry into the war inevitable, because there was a huge opposition inside the United States. of coming in for the second time. And there was much talk, well, it's a fait accompli. At one point, Roosevelt asked Churchill, since Europe has fallen, don't you think it's best if the British Navy is sent into American ports where we can look after it rather than falling into German hands? That's how much confidence they had in their European allies. But the single most important political military factor of that war is that Britain resisted and that Hitler, after the Battle of Britain, decided not to launch a land invasion, which had been the plan. So the Battle of Britain was a very decisive battle in the early years of the war. And here again, German historians are divided. They cannot explain, because they said despite the fact that the Germans had lost a lot of planes, these could be easily replenished, and the whole plan to invade Britain could have been carried out, but it was Hitler who took the decision, not the generals, who said, we're ready to carry it out. He said, no, let's leave Britain out, and instead he then went and invaded Russia, which proved to be his undoing. And then after the Battle of Pearl Harbor, the Americans came into the war, and that settled the issue. Because while the Soviet Union had the manpower and then gradually were building up a military industry to battle the Germans off, without American military support, both for Britain and the Soviet Union, it would have been a, you know, dubious enterprise. We don't know. It's difficult to say what might or might not have happened. But the convoys, the military aid, which grew in size, played a big, big part. So there were many wars being waged in one, and one was the fact that America was untouched. It was, its factories could produce calmly and in peace. It could turn out all the material that was necessary. And this, of course, made it economically a very vital power. Because prior to the Second World War, there had been two huge depressions in the United States. And these depressions had virtually wrecked American industry. And though Roosevelt then embarked on the New Deal, which was to provide a lot of state funding to get people back to work and to recognize trade unions, by the way, at that time. That was the time recognition was granted to some of the largest American unions after the struggles of the 30s and during and after the Depression. But they were threatened with another depression when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And that then enabled them to really use the power of the state and to embark on massive military rearmament. And they did that, and that also saved their economy. That's not the reason they did it. One should be accurate here. But the effect of that was to build the American economy in a huge way and make them one of the largest powers. Simultaneously, then, the Second World War, whereas the First World War had ended the domination of small states by empires, the Second World War began to do the same in the colonial world and had a big impact in the colonies, British colonies, in French colonies, in German colonies, in Belgium colonies, where movements arose for national freedom, for independence, and seeing the imperial powers weakened, thought they'd make a bid for freedom. And even in India, the largest of these countries, where the leaders of the Indian national movement, Gandhi and Nehru, had more or less come to an agreement with the British that there would be an exit strategy and over the next 10 years the British would withdraw, but they were angered that Britain had committed India to the war without consulting them. That was Nehru's argument. So they said, we will not back this war because you never consulted us. But there was another argument, which Nehru didn't use, but which Gandhi did. And this guy, one of the most astute politicians produced by India in that period, thought that the Japanese might win. Because on that front, the Eastern Front, Singapore had fallen, which sent shockwaves through the East. within the Indian nationalist movement, there were currents based on the ultra-nationalist theory of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they were organizing Indian prisoners of war taken by the Japanese into the Indian National Army to fight alongside the Japanese against the British. So Gandhi got nervous for the first time ever. This very self-assured politician got nervous, and he thought he might have to be negotiating Indian independence with the Japanese, because they were not that far away. And he then called for a Quit India movement in 1942, which was opposed by the Muslims, Muslim League, and by the Communist Party, which was backing the war because the Soviet Union was involved. So the Indian National Congress came out for calling on the British to quit India in 1942. Their entire leadership was locked up, etc., etc., etc. The British panicked because this was not an unimportant event and sent their top leaders to negotiate with Gandhi, one of whom was Sir Stafford Cripps, who flew over, a left-wing Labour Party member and who knew the Indian leaders well, and said, "Mahatma, I have come from the British cabinet with a blank check, but please don't come out against the war. This is a blank check." And Gandhi turned to him and said, "Sir Stafford, what is the point of a blank check from a bank that is so obviously failing?" But he got it wrong. At the end of the war, independence had to be granted to all the colonies. There's no way out of it. The Americans were foolish, very foolish, because the Cold War now had come into place. So that colored thinking that, you know, the war is now between us and Russia, we've defeated the Germans, etc. And so they backed the French in order to try to cling on to colonies in Indochina, which was very, very foolish. And so new wars erupted in parts of Southeast Asia. Enormous brutalities in Malaysia, in Indochina, and elsewhere, and the United States now increasingly took over the role of the former colonial powers. It was now a world power and the only power which could, as they said, defeat the expansionist aims of the Soviet Union. But curiously, as they realized themselves later, the Soviet leaders were deeply conservative figures in their own way. They were horrible to their own people and to the countries which they had been granted as part of the Second World War deal, Eastern Europe. But they kept to their side of the bargain, except where local movements refused to accept Soviet advice. Yugoslavia, Tito said no. He said, "I don't care," he said to Stalin, "what deals you've done with Roosevelt and Churchill. We fought in our partisans, we fought the Germans, and it's our country and our people, and we're not having King Peter back, whatever come, whatever may. And so, you know, you can go and jump." And when he was threatened, Tito sent back a very, very vicious message, which Gilas in his memoirs recounts. He said, "Look, unlike you, I'm not frightened of my own people, and we're now going to arm the entire Yugoslav population, and if you try and do any tricks and send your troops, we will fight you to the last man. And by the way, I have a revolver kept specially for you." How would the United States deal with its former imperial rivals? That became an important question. The powers that they had competed with. And here the Americans took, from their own point of view, a very far-sighted decision. They decided that because the communist enemy was much more important than anything else, they would build up these powers and make them strong again as allies in the great titanic struggles that lay ahead. And it was this fact that determined a number of things. That in occupied Italy, 70% of the apparatus of Mussolini's state was preserved. In Japan, where the emperor was in his chamber preparing his speech for the war crimes tribunal, the U.S. ambassador in MacArthur came in to tell him, no, we've decided we need you after all. And there were a few trials, and the top brass were taken Often some committed suicide, a few were executed, but in that country too, a large part of the old state apparatus was preserved, as it was in Western Germany, where there were, of course, more trials because that was the country that had unleashed the war. And they were sentenced at Nuremberg and executed, or some had killed. Goebbels and Hitler had killed themselves before. But on the minor level, the judicial structures, the educational structures, the civil service, and including some lower echelons in the military were kept because they were needed. And they provided a strong, strong conservative base for U.S. hegemony in Europe. And a lot of these people who turned terrorists in Germany, the Baader-Meinhof people in the 60s and 70s, when one argued with them saying this wasn't the correct way, they would say, you don't know what's going on. We see our parents who were Nazis now working again for the new war machine, and we won't tolerate it. And I said, it's one thing not to tolerate it and to fight it. It's another thing to, you know, kill a few people. Well, it doesn't actually get you very far. But anyway, those were different arguments. So this new empire now, under U.S. domination, where everyone in the West recognized the U.S. as the dominant power, had one countervailing or two countervailing forces. One was the Soviet Union. Then there was the revolution in China, which I'm not going to discuss today at great length. Indochina, and the Americans made a big, big mistake in imagining that the Chinese Revolution was all organized by the Russians and was part of a big Russian plot, and that Mao was simply a stooge of the Soviet Politburo. The Russians wished he had been. This long Cold War, which sometimes became hot, as in South Vietnam, finally led to an implosion in the Soviet Union, and with the changes that we now know since the 90s, making the United States the single hegemon of the period. And the new strategy essentially was to preserve the structures, but to expand capital, to remove all restraints, because in my opinion, all the reforms that were permitted after the Second World War, social democratic reforms in most of the Western world, were largely necessitated by the fact that they had this big enemy. And here they were successful, because the argument used to be against the Russians and the Eastern Europeans, okay, so you have subsidized health, subsidized housing, etc., etc. We have that too, but we have it together with one other thing, which is called freedom. And the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, and look at the diverse voices on our televisions and our radios and our newspapers. They can do what people can say, whatever they want, and to a certain extent, this was true. It was, of course, vastly exaggerated, but if you compare the newspapers and television networks of today with what they were in the post-war period, and especially the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there is a huge gulf. Now, economically, the decision that was taken was that the way forward for the world was the theories first propagated by Hayek a long, long time ago, in which he basically said that the market was the solution to everything and was the best judge and the best indicator of a country's development, and it people should be left to that. And the defeat and the implosion of the Soviet Union and the road taken by the Chinese then encouraged the elites in the West to impose what they called the Washington Consensus, by which deregulation, market norms became the dominant system. Now, there was a very great Hungarian economist who first taught at Columbia University called Karl Polanyi, who wrote in 1954 a very wonderful book called The Great Transformation, in which book he spelt out three important domains that would determine the future shape of the world over the century. He said there are three fictitious commodities which have not been produced for sale, but which have nonetheless become commodities, and it is on the future of these fictitious commodities that the world depends, unless it's kept under strict regulation and control. And these domains were economic, social, and ecological. None of them were produced for sale, and I quote him. Labor is only another name for human activity that goes with life itself, which is, in its turn, is not produced for sale, but for entirely different reasons. Land is only another name for nature, which is not produced by man. Actual money is merely a token of purchasing power, which as a rule is not produced at all, but comes into being through the mechanism of banking or state finance. Once these fictions become entrenched, they can destroy social existence. Pogliani again. Human beings would perish from the effects of social exposure, would die as victims of acute social dislocation. Nature would be reduced to its elements, neighborhoods and landscapes defiled, rivers polluted, military safety jeopardized, the power to produce food and raw materials destroyed. Shortages and surfeits of money would prove as disastrous to businesses as floods and droughts in primitive times. If you look at everything he said, at least on two key issues, he's proven to be totally right. In terms of the production of labor so far, it is not the case that it has become explosive, and one reason for that is that the number of workers, people working, has risen, though it's sometimes difficult to believe this if you live in the West, but it has risen from 1 billion in 1980 with the entry of capitalism into Russia and China and that all that region. In 2007, the figures for people in work in capitalist industries was over 3 billion. So there's been a huge increase in the size of the working class. And the effect of this huge rise of cheap, part-time labor has been to weaken the bargaining power of labor globally. Not just in these countries, but globally. And that is something which I think does affect the way societies are run today and in whose interests. In terms of money, the 2008 Wall Street crash confirmed in the most dramatic fashion what Pogliani had been arguing. Meltdown of capital markets was threatened and only averted, how? By massive state interventions running into trillions of dollars. So here you had the irony of societies run by elites that ideologically attacked any notion of the state being used to help the interests of ordinary working people or non-working people, but it was perfectly fine for the states used to be used to shore up banks engaged in dodgy practices, deregulated industries collapsing in order to save the financial markets. Three European countries nearly went under, as you know. Iceland, Ireland, and Greece. And the striking thing about this crisis is that within the political elites of people who went along with this entire way of thinking and this form of capitalism, there is not any sign that they're beginning to rethink, and that's what is frightening. And here the United States, you know, can't help out because economically it is indebted to China a great deal. And at the same time, it is the world's most powerful military nation, with a higher military budget than the next six countries put together. And so able to make up for its economic weaknesses through military actions. By the way, if you listen to American military politicians, like the defense secretary speaking a few days ago, he was totally opposed to any more interventions anywhere. Reading between the lines in what's happened over this last week, the big opposition to even the air attack on Libya was coming from the Pentagon. But the politicians, some of them at any rate, and Obama was convinced by that, argued that given how isolated the West had become as a result of the events in Tunisia, Egypt, etc., had to show that they were on the right side on this particular occasion, and bomb Libya. Now, we don't know how this will end. I think that this actually could strengthen Gaddafi, not weaken him. And if you notice what he's saying that. And the president said yesterday, we cannot stand idly by when a tyrant tells the people he will show no mercy. And the principal Arab state flying its jets together with the president's is Saudi Arabia, which has already invaded Bahrain and crushed the local people and the uprising there. So it doesn't carry much weight. But as we also know, the mercy of this sort, dispensed by the empire, doesn't usually drop like gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It doesn't. It's much tougher, much more powerful, much more destructive, and it usually blesses only the power that dispenses it, the mightiest of the mightiest. Thank you.
An impressively honest and forthright voice, especially considering it's carried by a nationally sponsored media carrier, Radio New Zealand. Military intervention is, of course, the sharpest and most undeniable aspect of a multifarious process of domination, which works largely through the moneyed world, as John Perkins and others have said. In the school in which I teach, which didn't feature any Americans, one of the main history textbooks was entitled America, the Land I Love, an interesting choice for Bangladeshi children growing up in Dhaka. Perhaps it's because I'm a teacher, but I keep coming back to the role of the education system in misleading young minds and giving them a false understanding of the world, one that's been engineered to support the lies which will be told to them in later life. And now we're going to conclude the show with regular speaker Noam Chomsky speaking from the 11th of May at Nottingham High School, Syracuse, on the topic of what drives US foreign policy and what we can do to change it.
What drives U.S. foreign policy and what we can do to change it? A good way to start an inquiry into what drives foreign policy is to start with what doesn't drive it. And that's pretty easy to determine. There's a simple method. Just take a look at the conventional theses as to the roots of foreign policy and ignore them, because you can quickly see that they don't work. So a major thesis constantly is that foreign policy is driven by noble intent, so humanitarian intervention and bringing democracy and so on. That claim, as far as I know, is close to universal. Almost every foreign policy initiative by any state expresses noble intent. And it's very familiar in our own history, back to the very beginning. So you might say that U.S. foreign policy begins when the Pilgrims arrived in Massachusetts. And they came with the most noble of objectives. You can see them on the internet if you look up the Great Seal of the Bay Colony of Massachusetts 380 years ago. It depicts an Indian with his spears pointed down, sign of peace, and a scroll coming out of his mouth saying, "Come over and help us." So the pilgrims who were coming were noble humanitarians who were responding to the plea of the poor pagans to come and Christianize them and help them and incidentally exterminate them. But that's one of those things, collateral damage, that's called these days. And as I say, that is universal. So if you read, say, Hitler's speeches when he was taking over Czechoslovakia or invading Poland, full of the most humane, uplifting rhetoric, or Japanese fascists when they were rampaging in China and in the hope, with the intention of creating an earthly paradise for the people they were massacring and protect them from the Chinese bandits who were inflicting damage on them. And that you might search and see if you can find an exception to that. It's pretty rare. So what it means is that the claim of noble intent simply carries no information. Literally, it's completely predictable, so therefore it carries no information, even in the technical sense of the word, so you can disregard it. A second thesis is that foreign policy is driven by what's called the national interest. What's the national interest? So, for example, is the, say, take the CEO of General Electric and the janitor who cleans the floor of his office, do they have the same interests? Well, not exactly. There's some respects in which there are some shared interests. For example, the interest in security. And it's very commonly argued that security, the search for security, is what drives policy. And that's pretty easily testable. So take, for example, the invasion of Iraq. Now, that was undertaken with the expectation that it would increase the threat of terror. In fact, it did, by about a factor of 7 the first year. Is that undertaken to preserve security? Hardly. There was recently an inquiry in Britain, the Chilcot inquiry, looking into the roots of the war, the planning for the war, and the head of their MI5, essentially the FBI, testified that both British intelligence and the U.S. intelligence knew quite well that there was no threat from Iraq, but that invading it would create a threat, which indeed it did. Others react pretty much the same way. Now, there's one exception to this. Foreign policy and domestic policy are driven by a search for security in a very special sense, security for those groups in the society that Adam Smith called the masters of mankind, those who basically own the society and, as he described, are the principal architects of policy and design it so that their own interests will be well served, no matter how grievous the impact on the domestic population. That's a thesis that holds up pretty well, has modern, more sophisticated versions, but it's simple and essentially true. So take, for example, the 2008 election. Obama won the election because he was able to outspend McCain, his rival. And the main reason he was able to do it was because there was a flow of funding from the financial institutions, kind of like the core of the economy these days. And they preferred him to McCain, so they poured money into his campaign, and he was able to swing the election. Well, they expect to be paid off. You don't give money for nothing if you're among the masters of mankind. And they were.